I was lucky enough recently to write two papers with Gary, together with George. And I just remember these papers being immense fun. That's really my main memory. As Sean said, I don't think we understood very much at all about lattices or condensed matter physics or conductivity when we started. But the thing that sort of sticks in my mind most is just this amazement and wonderment that we shared when we saw things like the Drude model emerging from general relativity. It was really a special collaboration, so I'd just like to say thank you. I'm going to give what's really a slightly old-fashioned talk. Everything I'm going to tell you could have been said in the 1990s. And in fact, I'm not really sure why it wasn't. But the roots of what I'm going to tell you go even further back to the 1970s. So this is my present to you, Gary. I want to give you back your youth. So think back to, you know, a time of flares and disco, when physicists were trying to make sense of this equation. So this is apparently what people did before string theory existed. You want to quantize gravity, and so the idea is very simple. You just take gravity and you treat it as if it was any other quantum field theory. You put the Einstein-Hilbert action into the path integral. You wick rotate in the hope, the somewhat desperate hope, that it's going to help with various convergent issues. And then you integrate over the metric. And most importantly, you then sum over various manifolds, gravitational instantons, which have different topologies. And, you know, with hindsight, we now understand very well that if you care about UV issues of quantum gravity, this really isn't going to help you. And this contains all the UV divergences of any other canonical quantization approach to general relativity. But nonetheless, if you think of gravity as some low-energy effective field theory that's valid at suitably large distances and low curvatures, this almost certainly is the right thing to do. And we have good examples. We have very good examples, especially in the context of ADS-CFT, things like the Hawking-Page phase transition, where we understand that this is the right thing to do and why it's the right thing to do and what various things mean. But in general, and especially in flat space, there's various subtleties that exist even if you try and treat this as a low-energy effective action. And I think everybody that's worked on general relativity, especially back in the day, has thought about this. And so I actually dug out an old paper of Gary's. Do you remember this? Because it's been almost forgotten. It's actually a lovely paper. But I think it's a beautiful paper. But Andy mentioned yesterday that the two of you have written 15 papers together, and it's an astonishing list. And those 15 papers include some of the most influential papers in quantum gravity of the last 30 years, but this isn't one of them. This was, I think, the last paper you wrote before you became a string theorist. The paper after this, you also wrote with Andy, and has 200 times more citations. That's not 200 more citations, that's 200 times more citations. But I think it is going to be one of the most influential papers, and I think this is a forgotten paper that people should go back and read, because I think there's interesting things within this. So what I'd like to do in this talk is something very straightforward. I just want to give one very simple example where you can make sense of this partition function, where you can do a gravitational instanton calculation in asymptotically flat space, where everything basically is under control, where you can sort of do precision calculations and get, you know, factors of two right in front of correlation functions and so on. So it's just one example, but I think it's particularly nice and simple example, and there'll be a few conceptually new ideas that emerge from this calculation that certainly surprised me when I came across them. I should say as well, this was a paper that was released last year. It was written with my graduate student, Carl Turner, who's absolutely fantastic. There's a few fairly tricky calculations that were needed for this project. Without exception, these calculations were done by Carl. So if at any time in the talk you think that looks a bit hard, that's the bit Carl did in this project. Let me tell you the punchline. And then I'll go through and tell you the calculation in more detail. So the context is the following. Take just flat space and think about a Kaluza-Klein compactification. So take Minkowski space in D plus one dimensions, take one of the spatial dimensions, and compactify it on a spatial circle. Okay, it's one of the most trivial solutions to the Einstein equations, classically. But quantum mechanically, this typically does not survive as a solution of the theory. And there's a long history about understanding instabilities of these Kaluza-Klein vacua. The simplest such instabilities simply come from a Casimir force. So if you do a one-loop calculation where the loops in the Feynman diagram can run around the circle, then what you find is that you generate a potential for the size of the circle. If you have massless bosons in your theory, the circle will want to shrink. And of course, gravity is interacting, so gravitons running around the circle make the circle want to shrink. And if you have massless fermions in the theory, the circle will want to grow. If somehow you manage to cancel that that Casimir force, there's a more dangerous instability that lurks, which is Witten's bubble of nothing instability. So it's a non-perturbative instability which destroys space. It's only really important if somehow you get to cancel that perturbative force, which always wins, is always the more powerful. Okay, there's a very simple way to cure both of these ills, which is simply to make the theory supersymmetric. So of course, there's an equal number of bosons and fermions, so the Casimir force vanishes, but the spin structure of Witten's bubble of nothing solution is incompatible with the periodic boundary conditions you would put on a circle to preserve supersymmetry. So it's typically assumed, and in fact it's typically true, that if you take a supersymmetric Kaluza-Klein compactification, it's stable. So the punchline of this talk is that there's a counterexample to this statement. And the counterexample is extremely simple. It's the following. It's any theory with n equals 1 supergravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions, where you take a spatial circle and you compactify down to 2 plus 1. So it turns out there's a somewhat different gravitational instanton solution, which I'll tell you about in this talk, which generates a superpotential, where the superpotential is the following. So R is the size of the circle, and sigma is the joule photon. So when you compactify with a Kaluza, on a Kaluza-Klein circle, you get a photon in the lower dimension, but now the lower dimension is 2 plus 1, so you can dualize a gauge field in 2 plus 1 in favor of a periodic scalar, and sigma is that periodic scalar. So this is the superpotential that's generated, and obviously the minima of the superpotential is as R goes to infinity. So the story is if you try and compactify n equals 1 supergravity theories on a circle, they'll dynamically go back up to flat four-dimensional space. Okay. So we were quite excited when we discovered this, but then having found the answer, we stupidly started to read the literature, and we found we got scooped. So we got scooped by about 3 years. I kind of thought we'd be scooped by 20 years or something, but in 2011, there's a very nice paper by Grimm and Savelli. It's one of those very long, detailed supergravity papers that if you're like me, you never read, so I had no idea about this. But they state very clearly that instantons will generically give rise to this superpotential. In fact, if you go further back, it's implicit in this old work of Harvey and Moore looking at D-brain instantons. So if you look at D6 brain instantons wrapping various G2 compactifications of type 2A, although they don't state this explicitly, it's kind of buried in their paper that this superpotential is there. Oh, it pushes the circle open, yeah. Okay, so we were scooped, but then we decided what we were going to do is just go ahead and calculate this anyway. You see, when most people say that they've done an instanton calculation, that they're kind of cheating. When most people say they've done an instanton calculation, what they really mean is they've counted the number of Fermi zero modes associated to the instanton, and then they figure that, well, it's going to be non-zero. And there's a lot more to doing instanton calculations than just counting fermion zero modes. So we figured we were going to do the hard work, mostly just so I could understand, or we could understand, how the nuts and bolts of this particular quantum gravity calculation fit together. And as I'll try and explain to you, it turns out that buried within those details are some what I thought were surprising and interesting conceptual issues, so that's what I'd like to tell you about. Okay. Good, so let's start at the beginning. I'm gonna talk just about pure n equals 1 supergravity. This is the action. It's extremely simple. There's a metric, so Einstein-Hilbert action, plus a spin 3/2 particle. It's not quite as simple as it looks. Buried inside the spin connection here is actually a Fermi bilinear, so there is a Fermi quartic term in the action, but it's very simple. Everything I'm about to tell you will be for this action. but it also goes through with only minor modifications for generic n equals one matter content that you add to this. Okay. Just to fix notation, the Kaluza-Klein-Ansatz, which you all know, is the following. So you're in four dimensions, you go down to three dimensions. The dynamical fields are the three-dimensional metric, the size of the circle, and the Kaluza-Klein gauge field. The metric also includes this fiducial scale L. Nothing can depend on L. You can always shift L away by various coordinate choices. So L is unphysical, and at the end of the day, that has to drop out of anything we compute. So this is the Kaluza-Klein-Ansatz. You plug it into the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action to derive the low-energy effective theory for these fields, for the three-dimensional metric, for the fluctuations in the size of the circle, and also for the Kaluza-Klein photon. You get this very familiar form. As I mentioned before, in 2+1 dimensions, you can swap the photon in favor of a periodic scalar. So if you do that, you write the low-energy effective action in terms of the three-dimensional metric, the size of the circle, and this compact periodic scalar sigma. Okay. And the goal of the project is simply to compute the quantum corrections to this low-energy effective action. And ultimately, what we're going to find is that as well as these kinetic terms, there'll be some potential term for R, which comes precisely from this superpotential that I showed you previously. Okay. So there's a bunch of intricate things you have to compute. There's some non-perturbative effects and some perturbative effects. And I've decided I'm going to tell the story a little bit backwards in this talk. So I'm going to jump in and tell you straight away about the non-perturbative effects, the gravitational instanton contributions. And the way I'm going to present it, there'll be a slight mystery when you compute those. And then we're going to return to the perturbative calculation and understand how to resolve the various mysteries that come about. Good. So for the classical effective action, these fields don't depend on Z. But you'll learn, George. Don't worry. But as I go on, there'll be various quantum calculations you have to do where you integrate over fluctuations. Those fluctuations do depend on Z. Okay, so whenever you do a quantum calculation, things can depend on all coordinates. Okay, so let me start with gravitational instanton. This, by the way, should be the universally recognized picture for the phrase, I'm looking for a solution to Einstein's equations. Fortunately, in this case, you don't have to be Gary to find the solutions. The solutions are extremely easy. Even I know what they are, because they're very restricted. We want to compute contributions to a superpotential, and there's a long story that actually goes back to the original work of Witten that explains that the gravitational instantons you need firstly have to be self-dual or anti-self-dual, and if you want them to contribute to the superpotential, they have to have exactly two fermionic zero moments. Okay. So the number of choices you have is fairly limited, and in this particular theory, it's a very simple solution. It's simply Taubnut. You could also have multi-Taubnut solutions in this background. It just turns out they have too many fermionic zero modes to contribute to the superpotential, so it's just this single Taubnut that's going to contribute. From the low-energy perspective, Taubnut, of course, is a Kaluza-Klein monopole. So these look like magnetic monopoles in the low-energy effective three-dimensional theory. So if you're summing over these as instantons, you're really doing the analog of Polyakov's famous calculation in 2+1 QED, but in gravity. Or because it's supersymmetry, it's more accurate to say you're doing the analog of the Affleck-Harvey-Witten calculation, supersymmetric 2+1 QED. We're not the first to consider this. There was a paper by David Gross in the 1980s who looked at these contributions to as gravitational instantons. And then more recently, there was a paper by Sean Hartnell and David Ramirez. And it was this paper by Sean and David that really inspired us to do this work. Good. So I actually deleted some slides because of lack of time. So let me encourage you to ask this question in the discussion session. But I'll just mention briefly now. Hiroshi's question is this something we should include in the partition function? Because we're interested in instantons around flat space, and the asymptotics of flat space is S2 times S1. But the asymptotics of this Taubnut is S2 with the S1 fibered over the S2. So it has slightly different asymptotics. And the folklore of Euclidean quantum gravity is you fix what's going on at asymptotia and then sum over different things in the middle. I claim that's not the correct thing to do in this theory, that there's a number of arguments that say you should allow various topologies at infinity, including these Taubnauts. And I'll be happy to tell you about them later. I can tell you a sociological argument now, which might be enough to convince you. If you don't do this, then most of string theory is incorrect. Okay? For the following reason. Think about type 2A on G2, and then view that from the perspective of M theory. These Taubnauts are precisely D6 brain instantons wrapping the G2. Okay, so if you don't want to include them, you don't include D6 brain instantons, but then by various dualities, you don't include any membrane instantons in string theory. Okay, best to include them. Good. But there are arguments directly from gravity. Okay, so this is the instanton that we're going to compute. And then there's a prescription that you do to calculate instanton contributions to various correlation functions. That includes computing the action of the instanton and figuring out the zero modes and figuring out the measure for the zero modes. And it's all sort of fairly algorithmic and fairly straightforward, with one exception. And the exception is to compute the one-loop determinants, so the quantum fluctuations around the background of the instanton that tell you the prefactor in front of this instanton contribution. So what I'd like to focus on is just how those determinants work in this particular calculation. So there's an old story. There's an old story that goes back to Hawking and Pope. And the old story is simply that these determinants are really simple. And the argument is the following. We have both fermions and bosons in the theory. The bosons are the graviton and the ghosts for the gravitino, and the fermions are the gravitino and the ghosts for the graviton. And so the determinants you get are a ratio of fermionic determinants over bosonic determinants. And because you have this supersymmetry in the game, that the background is self-dual, which means it preserves half of the four supercharges, and those supercharges that are preserved will relate the fermionic fluctuations to the bosonic fluctuations. And therefore, the spectrum of the fermionic determinants will be exactly the same as the spectrum of the bosonic determinants, and it looks as if they should just cancel, in which case the determinants are one, and you don't have to bother about them. Okay? It's worth stressing this is exactly what happens in Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions, or in super Yang-Mills in four dimensions. The problem is that this argument isn't watertight. If the spectrum was discrete, so that there was really a pairing between bosonic zero modes and fermionic zero modes, these would exactly cancel and this argument would be correct. But Taubnaut is a non-compact manifold, and there's a discrete spectrum, and then after some gap, there's a continuous spectrum. And what supersymmetry really tells you is that the range of the fermionic spectrum has to agree with the range of the bosonic spectrum, but it doesn't tell you that the densities of eigenvalues has to be the same. Okay? So we have examples that we know of where this argument breaks down that are much, much simpler than this example, just supersymmetric quantum mechanics. We have examples in supersymmetric quantum mechanics where the same argument will tell you the determinants should vanish, and they just don't if you calculate them. So the only thing you can do is just sit down and do the calculation. Which takes a little bit of work. It turns out supersymmetry helps you a lot in simplifying the determinants. But at the end of the day, when you do the calculation, you find that actually they don't cancel. So the determinants are given by the following expression. There's an ugly number, which I'll put on the, which we computed. I'll put on the next transparency. And then there's the following rather peculiar expression. Firstly, the one-loop determinants are divergent in this theory. Mu is a UV cutoff of our theory. It should be strictly less than the Planck scale to keep everything weakly coupled. But the divergence comes with the cutoff squared, and then there's this really weird power of 41 over 48 that comes in this. And then R is the asymptotic radius of the Taubnaut circle, and the determinants go as 1 over R squared, and again, there's this really weird power of 7 over 48. Notice that this power plus this power add up to 1. This follows basically on grounds of dimensional analysis. That's right. Yes. Yes. I'm not sure what non-renormalization theorem you would mean. I could give you an analogy where the. Oh, that's true. Do you know, if you go to enough supersymmetry, let me give you a slightly different example where I can tell you more details. Suppose you have three-dimensional gauge theories. So you can have three-dimensional gauge theories with 4 supercharges, 8 supercharges, or 16 supercharges. The determinants around the background of the monopoles in that case don't vanish for either 4 or 8 supercharges, but finally do by the time you get to 16. Okay, and so something is probably true here. I suspect they don't cancel in n=2 supergravity, but they probably do by the time you get to n=8, although I haven't done the calculation. This same effect appears in various places. It's the reason why the monopole gets renormalized in Seiberg-Witten theory, even though you might think that the one-loop determinants should cancel. And more recently, it appeared in the holomorphic anomaly of elliptic genii for certain, it's not genii, is it, genera? Elliptic genus for certain non-compact sigma models like Taubnacht. So it's something which has appeared over and over again in different aspects of physics. Okay, so this is what you get for the determinants, but it leads to a slight puzzle. So if you put everything together to compute the actual superpotential, what you find is the following. There's this ugly number C, which I've now written down here, but it's not going to play any role. What appears here, of course, is the determinants. Various things like the measure for the zero modes come in and give you factors of M Planck, so these are now dimensionless. And then what sits up here is the action for Taubnacht. There was actually quite a long controversy, about 20 years, about how you compute the action for Taubnacht and what boundary terms you should put on. And it was finally resolved in the 1990s by Rob Myers and company by embedding Taubnacht in ADS space. But this is the correct action. And then it becomes, as Polyakov taught us, complexified because this thing carries magnetic charge. Okay, so what's the puzzle? The puzzle comes from the two terms here. Firstly, this is the superpotential, and the superpotential should be a holomorphic function of chiral superfields, but it doesn't appear to be in this case. This thing that sits up here is holomorphic in the natural complex structure of the theory, but the fact we've got this strange 1 over r squared in the prefactor makes it look like it's not holomorphic in what it should be holomorphic in. That's the first puzzle. The second puzzle is that it also looks like it's UV divergent. Now, you know, this is a quantum gravity theory. We've made no attempt to embed this in string theory. We've just used general relativity. So it might be okay that it's UV divergent, but it just seems odd that something as robust as the superpotential should be depending on UV physics, should be sensitive to this. So what I want to tell you in the rest of this talk is firstly that the superpotential, when considered correctly, is 1, holomorphic, and 2 is actually UV finite, but is finite in kind of an interesting way, in a way that surprised us. So that's where we're going now. To understand both of these things, we actually have to return back to the original theory and start thinking about perturbation theory a little more carefully and how that changes the effect of action theory. Okay, so that's where we're going. Good, so let's look at some perturbative quantum corrections. So earlier I showed this was the classical low energy effect of action you get just by looking at the Kaluza-Klein ansatz. But you can start to do one-loop calculations, and there are one-loop changes to this effective action. Okay, so these are exactly the same one-loop calculations that would give rise to the Casimir force. They're Feynman diagrams that run around the circle. But now the Casimir force vanishes. What they do instead is they change the kinetic terms of the theory. Okay, so if you calculate these one-loop corrections, the L over R squared are the one-loop corrections, you see you get these sort of slightly annoying fractions that appear here. The thing that turns out to be important is that this number here, which is the one-loop correction to the radion, differs from this number here, which is the one-loop correction to the Joule photon. Okay, so let me tell you why this is important. So the two numbers are different. And it's important when you think about supersymmetry. Because I've dropped the metric now. This is the low energy effective action for the scalar fields. And supersymmetry means that R and sigma should be paired together in terms of a chiral multiplet. So this effective action you should be able to write it in terms of a complex chiral multiplet and some Kähler metric. Okay, that's what supersymmetry tells us. In other words, there must be a way to pair together R and sigma such that the action can be written in this form. And in fact, there is a unique way to pair up R and sigma. If you forget about these one loop corrections, so you drop that term and you drop that term, the way to pair up R and sigma to write it like this is R squared with this coefficient, which is precisely the action of Taubnacht plus I sigma. But when you take into account these one loop corrections with the precise coefficients that we calculated, there's a one loop correction to the complex structure. And what you need to write the low energy effective action in this form is to add this logarithmic term in m Planck squared r squared with a particular coefficient where the coefficient has to be 7 over 48 to match this. So what does that mean for the superpotential? It means that the 7 over 48, the slightly odd number we computed from the determinants, the one loop fluctuations, is actually what was needed to make the superpotential holomorphic after all. Because you take this, you plug it up here, the whole thing becomes e to the minus s, where s is now the correct one loop corrected complex structure that you can derive from perturbation. Okay, so this works out very nicely. Just as it should be, but we're still left with the fact that the superpotential appears to be divergent, whereas I claim actually it's finite. So let me end by telling you about how you should understand this divergence that appears from these one loop fluctuations. So there's kind of a folklore. I've been guilty about propagating this folklore in the past. The folklore is that pure gravity is finite at one loop, and pure supergravity is finite at two loop. And neither of those statements is correct. The correct statement is that the S matrix around flat space for pure gravity is finite at one loop, and the S matrix for pure supergravity is finite at two loop. But if you actually just sit down and calculate in, say, general relativity or in this theory, you'll find that at one loop, there could potentially, by dimensional analysis, be three logarithmic divergences in R squared, in R squared, Ricci squared, and Riemann squared, and you in fact get all three logarithmic divergences appearing. This is in the original Toft and Velten paper. So in fact, at one loop, pure gravity is as divergent as it possibly can be. The argument about why it's finite has nothing to do with a divergent structure. It's to do with various field redefinitions that you can make. So the divergences in R squared and in Ricci squared can be removed simply by redefining what you mean by the metric. Then you define a new metric is old metric plus R mu nu plus R times G mu nu with various divergent coefficients, which just absorb these terms that you generate in one loop. Meanwhile, by the same kind of field redefinitions, you can take Riemann squared and you can massage it into the Gauss-Bonnet form. But the Gauss-Bonnet form, of course, is just a total derivative, and so if you're interested about perturbative physics around flat space, it's just not going to contribute at all. But if you're interested in non-perturbative physics, which of course we are, the divergence in the coefficient of the Gauss-Bonnet term becomes important. So what happens here? You should go back to your action and add a Gauss-Bonnet term, alpha times chi, so chi is going to be an integer when evaluated on a particular background, and alpha is just the coefficient of this coupling. If you don't add it, it's going to be generated anyway at one loop, so you should go back and add it. And the one loop divergences tell you that alpha runs logarithmically. So if you start at one scale mu and you integrate out all the degrees of freedom down to another scale mu prime, alpha will run logarithmically with the following formula, where alpha 1 is like a beta function and is something which was calculated back in the 1970s. And I've written the general form here. If you have a graviton plus n three-halves, spin three-halves field, plus a number of vectors and a number of spinners and so on and so on. Okay, so how do you make sense of this? It smells very much like Yang-Mills theory, where you have a dimensionless coupling which is running logarithmically. But it's also rather different from Yang-Mills theory. In Yang-Mills, if you have g squared at a scale mu, you can actually do an experiment to measure that. You can do a local scattering experiment that'll tell you what the value of g squared is at mu. Here, alpha is something which only knows about the global topology of space. So you can't really do an experiment that tells you what alpha is evaluated at the scale mu. So it's not quite clear conceptually how you should think about this running. I can tell you what happens in a generic theory. You know, there's some various minus signs here, but in a generic theory, if you put alpha to be positive at some high scale, it will usually get smaller and smaller as you go down in scale. There'll be some scale at which it vanishes, and then it can keep going below that and becomes negative. So that's the way things typically run. In our theory, if you work out what this beta function is, you find that it's this number we've seen before. It's 41 over 48. So what does this mean? It means that if you compute the superpotential, but you include the coefficient of the Gauss-Bonnet term, there's a mu that came here, which was the divergences from the one-loop fluctuations, but the coefficient of the Gauss-Bonnet term should also run with the scale mu, and they appear in exactly the right way so that they combine together to give this RG invariant scale that I'm going to call lambda grav. Okay, lambda grav is there in analogy with lambda QCD. Just like in lambda QCD, you've got a dimensionless coupling. It runs logarithmically, and so the right thing to do is to replace it with some RG invariant dynamically generated scale. So that's lambda grav, and here's the general definition. So what we find at the end of the day is that the superpotential is holomorphic, but it's also nicely finite. But what appears in this coefficient is this new dynamically generated scale that came from the running of the Gauss-Bonnet. Okay. There's more to this. We're in a supergravity theory, and in fact, this scale lambda grav is naturally a complex scale. So the other parameter you should add is the theta angle, which multiplies the Pontryagin class. That gives the phase, e to the I theta gives the phase of this new scale. You can show that in supergravity, this was actually shown in the 1970s by Ferrara and Van Leeuwenhoek. If you look at supergravity, coefficient of Gauss-Bonnet plus I times theta actually sits naturally into a chiral multiplet, which means that just as in super Yang-Mills, lambda grav sits naturally into a chiral multiplet, and the superpotential should be and indeed is holomorphic, not just in S, but also in lambda grav. And this contains information, because N equals one supergravity has a chiral anomaly. There's a U1R symmetry, which is anomalous by the gravitational form of the usual chiral anomaly. And just as in Yang-Mills, the anomaly can be adjusted by the shifts of the theta angle. And you can think about lambda grav as capturing the information about that anomaly, that its charge under the R symmetry is telling you how the theory is anomalous. And so this superpotential is telling you a little more than just the fact that it opens up. It's remembering that the theory has this U1R anomaly as well. Okay, so that's the punchline of the talk. Firstly, there's this sort of slightly surprising effect that I didn't know about, but if you take four-dimensional N equals one supergravity and compactify down to three dimensions, that's not stable. You dynamically move back up to four dimensions. The thing that was more surprising for us is the way that the superpotential appears. It comes with this new scale that's naturally exponentially smaller than the Planck scale, in the same way that lambda QCD is smaller than the Planck scale. It's kind of hidden in gravity. It's coming from the running of the Gauss-Bonnet term and is playing a role in this instanton physics. Now, here, of course, we had supersymmetry, and we were compactified down to three dimensions, but neither of those were important for the existence of this scale. They were important to do a trustworthy, controllable instanton calculation, but I claim that any instanton calculation you do in four dimensions, this scale will show up. So in particular, if gravitational instantons contribute to anything in our universe, I don't know what they contribute to, maybe it's nothing at all, but if they do, then there is this new scale in nature, which is to do with the running of the Gauss-Bonnet term from some high scale down to some low scale, and that's the scale that multiplies these instanton effects. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you for your attention, and happy birthday, Gary.
That was a really cool calculation. I was curious about the last thing you were saying before you were talking about it. I thought you might say that, if I understood correctly, in the non-SUSY case, as you said earlier in the talk, that the Casimir force tends to perturbatively make the scale, the size, roll toward small values, right? So it's unstable toward a small radius.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas here, with N equals one supersymmetry, it's unstable toward a large radius. So I thought you might try and argue that four dimensions is preferred in the context of supersymmetry, but in the end you seem to be saying you thought the instanton would play a role anyway in some other way, I guess.
No, if I thought supersymmetry had anything to do with our universe, I would have made that statement. Given the scale at which it's broken, it's hard to make any argument like that. But I think the emergence of this scale from the running of the Gauss-Bonnet term had nothing to do with supersymmetry. And the supersymmetry allowed you to do a calculation where you can, things are under control. But But I should add, I don't know if gravitational instantons do anything in our world.
This might be a variant of the same question. If I have a theory with four superchargers in three dimensions, will it decompactify to four dimensions? I mean, one of the standard ways of building one is by Kaluza-Klein from some higher dimension, which might not involve a circle, but for example, you could think of a 10 or 11 dimensional theory, Kaluza-Klein. So will something like this effect sort of fundamentally destabilize a three-dimensional supersymmetric
theory?
Yeah,
so one thing I don't know about it is, I don't know about M theory on a fourfold.
Right.
It doesn't have four superchargers, right? It has two. But I don't know if that fourfold is unstable for its volume to decompact.
Well, it depends on which kind of fourfold. You can produce a four supercharged theory by using a Calabi-Yau fourfold. If you use a so-called Cayley manifold, wait a second.
Well, hang on, no, you're right. If you use spin seven, it's got two superchargers.
It's two, but if you use Calabi-Yau, it's four.
Ah, good. So actually, in neither of those cases do I know whether it opens up.
Right.
Yeah, if you do G2 cross S1,
right.
Then, as I
certainly,
say, buried in
certainly.
This Harvey-Moore
right.
calculation is this same
right.
instanton contribution.
Right. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
So when you said it opens up, did you compute the full supergravity potential, or is the...
Did I compute the full supergravity potential? Oh, yes, no, of course. We added the Kähler potential, and that's right. It opens up, yeah. Toby. I should say, a nice interpretation of lambda is that it's the scale at which the Gauss-Bonnet term vanishes. So, no, I don't think I can choose it to vanish. The Gauss-Bonnet term, if it goes from positive to negative logarithmically, and there's some scale at which it vanishes, that's lambda.